Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. How are you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing great, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. There was a new iOS update, and a lot of people are complaining about the podcast app, the native app. I'm not an iPhone user, so I wouldn't know these problems. There are rumors that after this update, it unsubscribed you from all your podcasts. So I know a lot of you won't be hearing this because you're already unsubscribed. So if you have a friend that listens to us, give them a nudge and tell them, hey, you should probably go resubscribe to the Gen Y because you might have got unsubscribed.
Or subscribe as well to your other podcasts.
Yeah, like The Peripheral. I don't know.
We just celebrated our 5-year anniversary. I know that was a little late because our anniversary was in June, but we celebrated in October here in Kansas City, and the live unedited audio from that is now up on Patreon for all subscribers. So if you're at the $2 level or above, you can listen to it.
So this is a kind of a local story to us, well, local to our state. The Springfield 3 case, which I know a lot of other people have covered, but highly suggested and sought after case. People wanted us to cover it. So here it is. What are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Tonight is the Springfield 3 case. It's also known as the 3 Missing Women case. It happened in Springfield, Missouri in the year of 1992, in June, actually.
I was still in high school.
What makes this case so mysterious is that two friends were out partying that night. They didn't really know where they were going to end up. And in the end, one of them suggested, let's go back to my house. And it was a house she shared with her mother. And they got home about 2:15, 2:20 in the morning. And this would have been on June 7th. And sometime between that time that they arrived home,
2 a.m. and 8 a.m.?
Yeah, somewhere between about 2:15 and 8 a.m., all three of these women disappeared. And the only clue left behind was a broken globe that covered the outside light. On June 6th of 1992, Stacy McCall and Susie Streeter graduated from Kickapoo High School. They lived in Springfield, Missouri. This is in the southern part of Missouri. in what they call the Ozarks.
Yep, just north of Branson.
And at about 8:30 that night, the girls go to their first party. Now, the school was offering a party that the graduates could attend, but they would be required to be locked in and to party without the use of alcohol.
Oh, well, that's just no fun now, is it?
Right. They graduate school and now they're being told you still have a lot of rules to abide by. And some of them want to do their own thing. So Stacy and Susie head off to their first party. They've known each other since elementary school. Now, Stacy was asked by her mom to let her know where she was going to be. And at around 10:30, Stacy called her mom and said that she was going to stay at her friend Janelle Kirby's house. That wasn't her original plan. Their original plan was to stay at a hotel, and then they were going to go to a water park the next day.
Teenage girls at a hotel. I'm sure the parents weren't cool with this plan.
No, you're right. And so Stacy's mom, Janice, said, no, I don't really want you at a hotel. So then later she let her know, I'm going to stay at Janelle Kirby's house. And so everything's cool. They have their plans, but they start going to different parties. And they later go to a neighbor of Janelle's. And then at some point when they get back to Janelle's later in the evening, Janelle is saying, I have a lot of relatives here, but we'll set you up on the floor. The two girls don't really want to sleep on the floor, I guess, because the house is filled with Janelle's relatives.
Yeah, all the families in from out of town. I would just think that would be kind of awkward anyways. So, yeah.
And this is just more of a summary because, trust me, there were other places they thought of staying and there were agreements. Okay, we'll stay there. And they got the okay from whoever was at the house. But, you know, long story short, Susie ends up saying that she doesn't feel that good. And sometime around 2:10, 2:15 a.m., they've told Janelle that they're not going to stay with her and that they're going to head back to Susie's house.
Now, Susie and her mother had just moved there recently. It was a smaller home, and I wonder if they were even all the way done unpacking. It seemed pretty recent from their move.
Yeah, but it had only been about 2 months that they had lived there. But it looked like a nice house. It's just on the smaller side. It looked to me like it might have been about 1,300 square feet, but that's just a guess.
That's bigger than my house, so maybe not so small.
What do I know? All right. So they drive in their cars. Stacy follows Susie, and they get to her house probably by 2:30 in the morning or so. And that's the last that they're seen is when they leave Janelle's house. They know they make it home, though, and we'll cover that very soon.
So morning arrives and people are calling the house because they were supposed to go to the water park that day. So her friends are calling, family's looking for them, but no one's answering the phone. People start showing up at the house, right?
Well, the people are Janelle Kirby and her boyfriend, Mike Henson. And Janelle and Mike were supposed to go with Stacy and Susie to a water park in Branson.
And if you don't know what Branson is, it's this cool little town in southern Missouri that has Silver Dollar City, has the Dolly Parton like something show, and a bunch of timeshare hotels and stuff. Springfield's pretty cool too, and the Bass Pro Shop with the nature place is cool. But there's water parks, there's theme parks down there. It's where you would go vacation, or it's where you would go for a weekend.
Because they had plans, Janelle said that she started calling around 7:30 in the morning to reach Susie. And at some point around sometime after noon, they show up over at the house. They're looking to see if everything's okay. And when they get there, they notice that there's broken glass all over the porch area. It's very apparent where it came from. There's a globe that covers the light next to the front door, and it is off of that. And it's been shattered on the porch.
So her boyfriend sweeps up the glass and they knock. There's no answer. And they go on in.
Well, I wonder where he got the broom at, because I can't believe that they would show up with a dustpan and a broom, right?
And I don't think there'd be a broom on the porch. I think the chronological order of events would it'd make more sense if they went in the house and got a broom and then cleaned up the glass. But we're just nitpicking, right?
Well, they actually do go in the house. Janelle walks around back and she can't really see anything amiss. The vehicles are outside. So she checks the front door and it's unlocked. So they go inside and they start asking, hey, is anybody here? And as they're walking around, it's really quiet.
So it's weird because their cars are there. It's a quiet home. They go into the bedrooms and they find that all their purses are lined up.
Yeah, there are steps that just a few steps that lead into Susie's room and they're right there. It's odd that their purses are right there. Their cigarettes are left behind, clothing.
The cigarettes are left behind. I think that's the most telling sign here. Not just the purses. I mean, my wife doesn't go anywhere without her purse, but anybody that I know that smokes, they don't go anywhere without their pack of cigarettes. That's just not a thing.
The three women are Cheryl Levitt, Stacy Streeter, who is her daughter, and her friend, Stacy McCall, who is 18. So a 46, 47-year-old woman, a 19-year-old woman, and an 18-year-old woman are all missing. The mother and daughter are known as chain smokers, and it was said that Cheryl would not walk to another room without a cigarette. So Janelle's thinking maybe they just left to get something real quick. They went to a neighbor's house or they went down the street, but they left their cigarettes behind. Of course, it is possible if they did just walk away and plan to come back, maybe they did bring a cigarette. Who knows how many cigarettes were supposed to be in the pack, right, Justin?
Yeah. One more detail. Their money was in the purse too.
Yeah, Cheryl Levitt had about $800 in cash and about $800 in uncashed checks in her purse. And jewelry was left around too, in pockets and on nightstands. It's obvious that robbery wasn't a motive. And as far as we can tell, nothing was really taken except for possibly some pictures.
The beds were slept in because they were unmade. I don't know. I don't make my bed, so maybe they'd never made their beds, but I'm assuming they would make their beds. And so it's apparent that they came home that night, got ready for bed, probably went to bed, and then were interrupted.
Right. They know that they made it home because they had used washcloths to take off their makeup, and those were found in the home. Now, you would think, you know, the police are called at some point. They are. And that's because Stacy McCall's mother, Janice, who's been trying to reach her all day, finally is told that she's been missing ever since early that morning. And she becomes very concerned. She heads over to the house. Now, when she gets there, she checks out the answering machine because she thinks that maybe there's a message on there that might explain what happened or where they went. Maybe there was a call like, we need your help, come over here, whatever. She plays the messages. And one of the messages is a strange man who says some disturbing things, I guess, of a sexual nature.
And this is the early 90s. The answering machines weren't that high tech. So as you played the messages were automatically deleted.
And that may be what happened because Janice didn't really know how it got deleted. I don't think she would have done it on purpose. And then we also find out that when Janelle was there with her boyfriend, that she received two calls while she was there at that number. And both times that she picked up, someone was being very lewd on the phone with her.
Yeah, she hung up the first time and they called back immediately. It's very impeccable timing for this to happen. I think of the East Area Rapist or other cases where the perpetrator of the crime would call and torment the victims or torment people that were left behind.
The other problem, aside from a deleted message, is that more than 18 people were probably in that house over the course of that day. And it's because people were curious about where these women had gone to.
Well, you have two families that are impacted. You have Streeter's family, and then you have McCall's family. Then you have all the friends that they were supposed to hang out with that weekend. So lots of people are at the house. You know, we talked about the placement of the purses. I'm just going off of where they said the purses were. I don't know if they moved them. It's impossible to say. We don't know if she deleted that message or if it just auto-deleted when she played it. But being that it is the 1990s, there still are phone records, which doesn't seem to really pan out. And I don't know if the police officers trace these calls back to their origins, but it's typically explained away in most documentaries and other places that you'll hear about this case, that back in the 90s, people just crank called each other. I mean, there was the whole, was it Jerky Boys, you know, whatever. And that did happen, but the timing of this is very questionable.
Now, because so many people had gone into the home, it really gets this investigation off on the wrong foot. It's very reminiscent of the JonBenet Ramsey case, where you have too much contamination, you have too many questions. Even if they look for all this minute evidence, like hair evidence, DNA evidence, whatever it is,
fingerprint,
you have no idea if it's relevant or not. I know you can try and track down who supposedly had gone into the house. And trust me, the police did that. You can try and eliminate them, but there are so many variables with that. So it gets off on the wrong foot. And not only that, but Stacy and Susie, because their plans kept changing, you know, some people had said that they had made plans with them and then they didn't show up. This is a very confusing situation. You had Stacy's mom, Janice, who didn't know where her daughter was at all. Even though her daughter said, "I will be here," that's not where she was. Now, this is what happens with teenagers, right?
Yeah. Plans are fluid. You know, the one good thing, though, is the police understand that three women do not go missing just randomly. They do not decide to run away together, go on a vacation. This isn't like a single teenager or single adult that just decides to drop off the face of the earth. This is three people. And they take that seriously, and they do file a missing persons report. So I applaud them for that, even in the midst of all the confusion and chaos of a tainted crime scene.
Well, the first place to start is with the three women. Who were they? What were their backgrounds? What was going on with their lives at the time? Stacy McCall, there's not much to say. She modeled wedding dresses. She came from a very good family. Not much to say there. She wasn't into drugs. There's really nothing to point out about her, other than she was well-loved and well-liked. Now, on the other hand, Cheryl Levitt and her daughter, Susie Streeter, they shared a house together. But in the year prior to that, Susie had left the house twice. And this is because they would be at odds at times. And that's probably pretty normal, don't you think, Justin? A daughter and her mother, there can be friction there.
Yeah. I mean, I remember my brother and sister moving out and moving back in a few times. I did it once myself. Second time I moved back home, didn't work out too well. I was gone pretty quick.
Susie Streeter worked at a movie theater. She had some troubled relationships. One of her ex-boyfriends had started abusing her, and so she had to file a restraining order on him. His name is Mike Kovacs. She had moved out with him into his grandmother's home. It was just months later that she moved out and moved back in with her mom. And then after that, the following year, she moved in with her brother who had come back into town. And he was 9 years older than she was, and he had alcoholism issues. He and his mother were at odds at times, and he was at odds with his sister at times. But when he moved back, it seemed like he wanted to kind of patch things up with his family, and he was able to do that with his sister. So she moved out and moved in with him. They got a place together, but there was friction building there because of his alcoholism. The incident that kicked off her going back to live with her mom again was she had shown back up to their place and he had his music up real loud. And so she said, "Would you turn that down? It's too loud." And he took offense to that. He ended up getting pretty aggressive with her. And so she moved out. That set her mother off, then sent him his birth certificate. I think that was her way of saying, "I'm disowning you. You can just go do whatever you want to do, but stay away from us."
Pretty brutal.
And so her brother, Bart Streeter, is one of the first suspects in this case, because one of the last things to happen was, you know, that Susie had lived with him and there was this altercation. Now, there are rumors about a fork being involved or some other violent attack involving a weapon. But as far as I can tell, there was mostly just shoving and shouting, but
things thrown. It was just a more a heated verbal altercation.
But when you have these family splits like this, where you have a sibling that's splitting off from, say, a mother and a sister, there's still pain there and there's still fear there. I mean, if he's drinking and he can't control himself, who knows what else he would do, right? Mm-hmm. And then beyond him, you have her ex-boyfriend who she took a restraining order out on. And in the report that she filed, she said she feared for herself because he was abusive and had made threats against her. And he had slashed her tires. He had done this not just on his own, but with a female accomplice as well.
Normally, in most cases, I would say, we got a good suspect. Let's roll with that. But we got to keep going. There's a whole list.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better. Notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
The police do look at Bart Streeter. They do look at Mike Kovacs, but they're not the only ones that are on the radar here.
She has a current boyfriend, right?
She has a current boyfriend whose name is Dustin Rekla, and he is pretty close in age to her. He had recently gotten in trouble because he and some of his friends had broken into a mausoleum and they were stealing gold teeth out of corpses' skulls.
Well, let's expand upon this a little bit. They were decapitating bodies and ripping the teeth out and then throwing the skulls into trees. That's some pretty morbid stuff.
They even set one skull on fire to illuminate the area so they could better extract the teeth they needed.
And then they would take these teeth, or the gold fillings, really, to a pawn shop. A pawn shop, I would hope, wouldn't buy a human tooth with a gold filling. So they would take the gold out, which would just look like gold shavings, and then sell them.
Yeah, one of the guys, and this is Dustin Rekla, he's the one who puts his ID down to sell this gold to the pawn shop. And according to his buddy, Dustin didn't actually do any tooth extraction, and he didn't actually enter the mausoleum. He was simply there to help sell the gold so that they could make the money. But this is still a crime.
Yeah, desecration of a corpse, vandalism of this cemetery, just a lot of nasty stuff going on.
Now, you might think, well, these are just teenagers trying to make some drug money,
And that's what they're doing. But after they're caught with this, they all try to leave town.
When a huge event like three people go missing, well, all of a sudden everyone's dirty laundry looks real bad.
When police questioned Michael Clay, he was really pissed off at Susie Streeter for talking with the police about Dustin and himself. And his comment to the police was, "I hope those bitches are dead."
And he'll later come back and say he was having a personality conflict with the investigator. He was having issues with the women, but I'm sorry. When you say something like that during a police interrogation, you just put a big old target on your head as a prime suspect, just like other suspects we'll talk about later.
Yeah, you ask yourself, you know, in this instance, Dustin Rekla had been dating Suzanne Streeter. And the only reason he's an ex is because when she found out that he had been doing this, she dropped him. And not only that, but the police came and spoke with her and she gave a statement. So these guys were all facing court, and he has his ex-girlfriend saying that she'll cooperate. She could end up on a witness stand. So this looks bad. This looks like, well, maybe these women disappeared because we have these guys over here that are facing trial. And if this major witness who she was dating him can't show up, then maybe the case goes away.
If you're capable of pulling out dead bodies and cutting their heads off and ripping teeth out, what else are you capable of? I don't know if the living now is that important to you. It's like serial killers. They start mutilating and abusing animals, things like that. And I'm like, well, if these kids are capable of doing this to a corpse, what else are they capable of? You know, the brother, he's an alcoholic. He might be abusive, but is he capable of abducting three people? Maybe, maybe not. But when you talk about desecrating a dead body, all of a sudden my spidey sense is going. And he's an ex-boyfriend.
And they're selling this gold for drug money. So who knows what kind of drugs they're using? Are they using meth?
It was called crystal back in 1992.
Well, if they're using crystal, are they making the best decisions here?
No. I think anyone that's seen Breaking Bad can get a pretty good grasp on what meth does for you.
The suspect list is still growing. So Susie Streeter seems to have a lot going on in her life. And her mother, you know I said there's some friction there, but really, she loved her mother. And she really looked up to her mother. And in fact, she wanted to be a cosmetologist like her mother was. Her mother was very popular as a hairstylist. Susie Streeter wanted to follow in her mother's footsteps. In fact, she was going to go off and do just that post high school. Cheryl Levitt had been married and divorced twice. We don't know of her having any boyfriends since the second divorce. And that divorce happened in 1989. So since this case is in 1992, that's about 3 years, maybe about 2.5. We don't know of any boyfriends. Now, I can't confirm this, but I have read that some people said that she may have dated Gerald Carnahan. I don't have any proof of her dating Gerald Carnahan.
But he was a bad dude living in the area at the time.
Right. He was convicted of murdering a woman named Jackie Johns. Yeah, the rape and murder of Jackie Johns happened in June of 1985. So that's 7 years prior, but in the same month. And he had dumped her in Lake Springfield. So this is very much a strong suspect. He's very capable of making three women disappear.
Yeah. But he had a rap sheet where he had broken into people's homes, attempted rape and kidnapping, and attempted abduction of another 18-year-old.
But again, we're not done with suspects here. And we're going to say suspects. Some people would say persons of interest. But really what it comes down to is, who might have made these three women disappear?
And I will say that anyone that's been out on, say, the sex offender registry or you know, the Crime Stopper maps where you can pop in your home address and then see all the wonderful people that live around you. This is how I feel about this case, is these three women go missing, and then you start to realize how many creepazoids live in this area and were operating around at the same time that they go missing.
Yeah, one of those things that people often bring up when they say that there was a murder or a kidnapping, they'll talk about the area that it happened in. It happened on Delmar Street. And in that area, it's actually a really nice area with some really nice homes. And in fact, the house that Cheryl and her daughter Susie lived in had some pretty nice fencing around, I'd almost call it privacy fencing, around the property, where they're kind of isolated. They have a business on one side, a house on the other, but the fencing kind of goes all around the property.
So other people that were in the area at the time, there was a guy named Larry Dwayne Hall, and he had a twin brother named Gary. So Larry and Gary, and these guys lived in the Missouri area and were Civil War reenactment dudes, actors, I don't know. So they would travel around a lot to different places, and they most likely had a van of some kind. But Larry would be charged with the abduction and murder of Jessica Roach, who was a 15-year-old girl riding her bicycle down the street. A bus driver was coming down the road and sees this bike in the middle of the road. And that's when they know that she's gone missing. The police will later find Larry and they ask him about Jessica. And at first he's very standoffish, but once they pull out a picture and show him, he starts to break down and cry. And he pretty much gives them a full confession. He admits to what he's done. Then he goes on to admit that he had picked up a woman in Claremont in Indiana. And he goes on and talks about a few other people that he has abducted. Again, he's been driving around to these different reenactments, so he's on the move. But when the police look into disappearances in Claremont, they find that there is a Georgia Shrive who went missing at that same time in the same area. They're kind of like, is this the guy? But he sort of shuts down at that point. His brother, Gary, we'll talk about how his brother was a bad dude. In Larry's vehicle, they find articles about Tracy Rettler, somebody else who had gone missing. They found tarps, knives, rope, condoms, pretty much a murder kit. His twin brother says that Larry is a prolific serial killer and has been active for over 20 years. Way to go, brother, to stop this from happening.
Yeah, thanks for alerting the authorities.
And then I think, well, there's Larry, who obviously is a bad guy. And then we think there's three women that went missing. Now, yes, one man with a gun can probably control multiple victims. But in this case, we have Larry and his brother, Gary. So we have two people that might make more sense of how they got three women to comply.
And so the question is, were they in the area?
It's questionable, but it seems that they were in the area. At the time of their questioning, they didn't have good alibis, but they weren't exactly questioned about this case specifically. Who's the next winner on our list?
Well, the next one is Stephen Eugene Garrison. Garrison told the police about a friend that he says had confessed to killing these women during a party. Of course, they're all drunk. And he said that apparently he had given the police information that only someone who knew what had happened would know. But is that true?
There wasn't that much detail to this. A broken light cover on the porch, no murder weapon found, no signs of struggle. I'm sure that the first news article that came out had a lot of these details. So I'm not sure what somebody could have said that the public didn't already know or just assume.
Well, the police did execute search warrants at two different sites in Webster County. Now, this search seems to be pretty private, right? I mean, there aren't really a lot of details on what was found. One of the properties that was searched was owned by Francis Lee Robb Sr. Now, there's a reporter who has written about this case, and she says that there were a couple of rings and some other materials found related to Cheryl Levitt and Susie Streeter in a shoebox on the property, or at least at one of these properties that was searched. I wasn't able to find much on this other than from this reporter named Kathy Baird.
Yeah, I would assume that if there truly was rings found that could tie back to the Springfield Three, the police would be all over this and this guy would be charged.
Unless there's incompetence or a cover-up, Justin.
Oh, yeah. I will totally accept the incompetence, or at least maybe the unknowing, like they didn't know what they had. But how would a reporter know what they confiscated from a search warrant? Unless it goes to trial and it's admitted as evidence, I don't see the police talking to reporters or the public about things that they've taken from a drug house.
Garrison was convicted of rape and served time.
So we have another bad dude with a rap sheet who claims he has inside knowledge about this case.
Right. And he got 40 years in prison for raping and terrorizing a woman in Springfield in 1993. So that's within a year of the missing women. Our next suspect comes from Florida.
That would be Robert Craig Cox. And anyone that's familiar with this case knows all about this gentleman. He was born in 1959. He joined the Army. He was an Army Ranger. So to give you a little background on Cox, December 30th, 1978, a woman named Sharon Zellers, 19 years old, was getting off work at Disney World. On her way home, she had stopped at a grocery store, and then she was abducted. That same night, Robert Craig Cox was on vacation with his family in Orlando, and he was out and about while his family was back at the hotel. And he comes back, and he's bleeding profusely from the mouth. There's blood all over his shirt, and his mother's freaking out like you would, because here's your 19-year-old son, and he's covered in blood. And she takes him to the hospital so he can get emergency surgery done on his tongue, which has been severed. He tells a tale of being at the local skating rink, getting into a fight with a large black man who punched him in the face, and he bit his tongue off from the strike. The only problem is the way the tongue has been bitten off, it appears that the arch of the bite is coming from the outside, as if somebody had bit his tongue off and he didn't bite it off himself. Also, he doesn't appear to be beaten and battered as if a large black man had punched him. Also, he says that during the night, he was driving around and he pretty much got lost, and that a good Samaritan had offered to give him a ride back to the hotel. The police will find the body of Sharon Zellers in a sewer just a few hundred feet away from the hotel room that he was staying at. Police didn't have much to go on. In the victim's car, they found some hair samples, typo blood, and a boot print, none of which belonged to the victim. When they questioned Robert, they tried to verify this fight he claims he had. They can't find anybody that witnessed it. The skate rink owners don't even remember seeing him there that night. When they try to find this good Samaritan that gave him a ride home, that guy doesn't exist either. And I'm just wondering to myself, why did he get a ride from somebody else? That just doesn't really add up to me.
Well, he is visiting the area, so he's got that on his side, but everything else is against him.
They say this boot print was made by a combat boot, military-style combat boot. This guy's fresh out of training. So that adds up. But the police will not charge him, and he will return to California with his family. While in California, around 1985, he is charged with two separate abduction attempts of young women. The first one, he held this woman at knife point. She grabbed at the knife and he pulled it away, cutting her hands. And she begged him to take her to the hospital. And he complied and then took off once he dropped her off there, which is very odd to me that he would do that. His next victim, Gidget Wickham, he abducted her from an airport parking lot, told her that he wanted to be driven to the mountains, something weird. Gidget talks him into driving to her friend's house, and again, he complies, but I'm glad. He will hold her friend at gunpoint, but then they get away, and the cops are called, and they find him. And in his car, they find pretty much a bag of guns and a kill kit. So he pleads guilty on one count of kidnapping and two counts of assault with a deadly weapon. And he receives a 9-year prison term. While serving time in California, Florida decides, you know what? This might be our guy. Well, let's just say that it just makes way too much sense that he was there the night that Sharon went missing and was found murdered 5 days later.
Very close to where he was staying, just within 300 to 400 feet of his room.
So he goes to trial. They have a hair analysis person come in. Now, we know hair analysis isn't exactly all that it's hyped up to be, especially back in the 1980s. Probably not an exact science, but they do have this boot print. They do have him there at the same time. The blood type also matches, but again, that's up to over 40% of the population has type O blood. If you remember our Girl Scout murders case, there was a whole bunch of type O blood in that case. You can't really match it to people. You can only exclude people with it. The jury thought this was plenty of evidence, and they charged and convicted him. He is handed a death sentence. Of course, he appeals his death sentence, and this goes all the way up to the Florida Supreme Court, which actually overturns it. So in 89, not only do they overturn it, but they say the jurors got this wrong. There was not enough evidence to convict, and then he's released in 1990. That is unheard of. Normally, I would applaud the court system for doing this. I'm all about letting the wrongfully convicted walk. But this guy, if we had DNA evidence back then, if we had more ways to connect him to the crime, I would side more on he was definitely guilty of this than looking innocent. I think of the case of Kirsten Lombardo, the teenage girl that was charged in Vegas for stomping to death a man based solely on hearsay, and the boot print didn't match. And she's still sitting in prison. So I have problems here with the court system actually saying, let him out. There's not enough evidence, when we have plenty of other cases that make zero sense that the person accused is actually guilty. But they overturn his conviction and they let him walk.
This was very upsetting to the jurors, and reading their comments after he was released, or at least after the Supreme Court reversed the conviction, they were livid. Comments like, our system is broken. And that's something Justin has said before, but just think about it. They really know that this guy has done it. And yet the court, the Supreme Court of Florida decided you didn't have enough evidence to convict this guy. Let him out.
It's mind-boggling to me. I wish I would see this more in other cases, just not this one. I like seeing what they did. I just hate that they chose this case as the one to set the example of beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, you're probably wondering, what the heck does this have to do with the Springfield 3? Well, he's out. He moves back in with his parents, who happen to live in Springfield, Missouri, just a few months before this disappearance happens, right?
He had worked as a mechanic at a used car dealership. He may have worked with Stacy McCall's father. And then after that, he went on to become a utility line locator.
So a utility line locator, they get a truck, they get the uniform, and they can go up and knock on people's doors and tell them there's a problem, and they would not be considered suspicious. It is theorized that he worked as a mechanic, saw this man's daughter, honed in on her, and then possibly went to their house, followed her that night in uniform, pulled a fast one on them.
There are no signs that there was a struggle in that house on Delmar Street, aside from that light cover that was shattered on the porch. So someone had to be able to get these women to comply very early in the morning and to leave the home with especially Stacy, they believe, was mostly undressed.
Again, this guy's been found with weapons and guns in the past. It's very plausible that he could get three women to comply with that.
There were no signs of a break-in. Back then, after the three women went missing, it was reported that a lot of people were locking their doors at night. And so you kind of wonder, did they lock their doors? I have read that Cheryl had made sure there were good locks on the doors.
I didn't live in Springfield, Missouri at the time. I lived in Kansas City. From the 1970s all the way up to the mid-90s, crime skyrocketed. And from 1995 till now, it's been on the downhill. I don't think that Springfield was immune to the crime that was happening. And this isn't the 1950s. So I think everyone locked their doors. And when I hear or read some news article, everyone started locking their doors after this heinous crime was committed. I think that's just a headline. That's just clickbait. They go to the nursing home down the street and say, what do you guys think of this horrible crime? And they're like, oh, I'm locking my doors at night. Well, yeah, whatever. Everyone locks their doors.
It's a good point. Maybe they're just double checking to make sure that all the doors are locked.
Yeah, because I think people would be more prone to leave their doors unlocked today because there's less crime. But if you watch the news, well, there's a serial killer around every corner. But in the 1990s, crime was really bad. So I would just assume that people were locking their doors. And I would assume that whoever came into this house did it under false pretense or knew the family. Now with Robert Cox, he does have this tie-in, but a lot of the other ones have a connection too. His seems to be one of the more solid connections as far as somebody that didn't know the family very well. When the police would question him, he would give very incriminating statements saying, I know they're dead. I know who did this was experienced. I know they're buried close by, which it's not exactly incriminating himself, but it sounds very suspicious. I think, well, of course, whoever did this is experienced or whatever. I mean, he's not saying anything that's not completely unfounded. His girlfriend says that he has an alibi for the night. He was with her and that they went to church the very next morning. Years later, he'll be handed a life sentence in Texas for a aggravated armed robbery where he stuck a gun in a 12-year-old's face and roughed her up. So Texas took care of him. You don't mess with Texas. But since then, his girlfriend says, oh, by the way, that alibi? Nah, that didn't happen. He told me to say that. Now, as soon as his girlfriend recanted, Robert Craig Cox's parents jump in and say, no, he was with us that night. I'm like, really? You remember where he was the night of, like, how do you remember years ago? So this whole alibi situation looks very fishy to me.
And we don't know. We don't know if it's because he actually was at the home on Delmar Street, or if he just doesn't want to face any charges because he doesn't want to be hassled by the police.
He's already been on death row once. He could probably get it again. Missouri definitely has the death penalty, and we will off people, not quite as quick as Texas, but we will do it. Robert Craig Cox also makes a statement that he will come clean, or he will tell the truth once his mother passes away. but he doesn't want to upset her. So he's going to keep quiet for now, which that pretty much is admission that you were involved with this, but he's such a scumbag. We don't know if he's just railing against the cops and the media for attention.
Right. And that's what a lot of the police suspect, is that after talking with him or hearing reports of what he has said, they feel like he just wants the attention. He's got nothing to lose. He's in prison. So maybe to pass the time, he decides to jack with everybody.
But you kind of hit on something there. You said he has nothing to lose, but he definitely has things to gain. If he can get the cops to believe that he has some part in this, maybe they'll reduce his sentence. Maybe they will negotiate with him. That's quite a motivation for him to insert himself into something to get leverage.
We have a lot of suspects, Justin. People that knew the missing women. We have people who are definitely rapists and murderers. If this was a sexually motivated crime, then that could explain one of these people being involved. But that early morning, we also have reports of someone who was a peeping Tom. And shortly after 1 a.m. on June 7th, a woman was alerted to look outside of her home when her dog started growling. When she looked out of her kitchen window, she saw a man looking in through her neighbor's window. And he was tall, thin, and was wearing a ball cap. So she turned on some lights and he moved away quickly. And she said she didn't see him get into a car or anything. He just walked away at a fast pace and then he was just gone. She never heard a car. Another neighbor who lived in that same area reported finding broken plants under a window of his house and a pocket knife. So now you have someone who, this was about an hour to an hour and a half before the women got into their beds, probably. There's a strange man seen in the neighborhood who's looking in houses. So this could be a random crime.
Exactly. I mean, this sounds like East Area Rapist or Richard Ramirez happening right here. Springfield, Missouri is not a bad place. I swear to God, it's not. It's a nice area. When you think about all of these suspects, when you think about all of this stuff going on, you'd think that this is just the worst place on earth, and it really isn't.
Yes, this investigation is very much being driven by Stacy McCall's mother, Janice. In fact, after these women disappeared, she started printing up missing posters. You know, have you seen these missing women? And had pictures of the women, details about their ages, their height, their weight. And so that question will pop up for different families. What is it worth to find out the truth? What do you think, Justin, if Robert Craig Cox approaches her with a deal, approaches the police with a deal? I'll tell you everything you need to know, but you have to meet my demands. And then you have Stacy McCall's mother who has to probably, I imagine that her opinion matters here. Her input matters. So what does she do here? Does she just say, yeah, we need to talk about this. We need to figure out what to do.
Well, that's it. If she is interested, she's going to be the one that puts the pressure on law enforcement to interview him. She's going to be the one that is the driving force to get the prison warden to give him a TV or move him to another section block or get a judge to reduce his sentence. But if he does have something to do with these three missing women, does he get immunity now? You know, like,
I don't know. I don't know if they would negotiate anything that would change his current deal. I don't know that they can do that, but maybe he does get perks. I do know that because of these missing women posters, because of the publicity that this case got, it affected the case. They managed to get a lot of tips in. In fact, there are more than 20,000 documents related to this case.
And they have like a $40,000 reward for anyone with information that leads to the women or the perpetrator.
Let's first talk about the tips that come in. Some of these tips seem very interesting, Justin. In fact, there were a couple of actually more than a couple of reports of people seeing a van.
Yeah. And actually the day of, a woman saw a van pull into a driveway around 6 a.m. So that's pretty early. And it falls in the window of time of when they went missing. She says that the woman behind the wheel appears to be Susie, and she's crying and distraught. She also goes on to say that she hears a man yelling from the back of the van, "Keep calm, get us out of here." Now, the road they're on is sort of a dead-end neighborhood, and you can't get to the highway from there, so you have to turn around and go back the other way. It's an older Dodge van. She says it's a celery green color. But she doesn't come up with this the day of the abduction or disappearance. She comes out with this later when she sees the missing persons posters. I don't know how much stock I put in this. I don't know if she could have seen all of this in such a short amount of time or heard this really, unless all the windows were down. It just seems odd. The police put out APBs on this van. They actually buy a similar van. They park it in front of the police station with a phone number to call if anyone has seen it. I think there's like a paper boy and some other people that had seen the van the same day, but one of them said the van was brown. Another one said it was gray. I think of the DC sniper case where everyone saw a white truck. Who knows what's valid here as far as witness descriptions.
There was also a man who saw what he says is a suspicious van parked in a parking lot, and he wrote down the license plate on a paper that he had, but then later he decided to throw the paper away. He comes forward later after all this comes up about the vans, and he's like, damn it, I had this written down, but I don't have it anymore. And I believe they used hypnosis on him, but he can only remember the first three characters on the license plate. So the police attempt to use this when they start searching to try and find a match, but it doesn't pan out.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
There's a journalist that is very passionate about this case, Kathy Baird, and she put some attention on this. She kind of reinvigorates this case in 2000, so 8 years after the disappearance. Some of the tips she gets in, a lot of the public find very questionable. We have tarot card readers and psychics who give visions and whatnot, but she claims that many of the tips that come in cite the local area hospital, which is the Cox Hospital, which Robert Craig Cox, Cox Hospital. And they say that the south side of the parking lot is where the bodies are buried. So this journalist, she hires a ground penetrating radar scanner guy to come in and scan this parking garage.
His name is Norlander, and you know, everyone cites his credentials as being he was one of the people brought in to look for bodies after 9/11. So he knows how to use his equipment.
He finds three anomalies here that he claims are consistent with graves or shallow graves. This parking garage was actually under construction at the time of these disappearances. Now, the police will say, well, that means that that's not valid because as they were turning the ground to put this parking structure up, they would have found the bodies. Meanwhile, the family and others say, no, that's the perfect time to bury the bodies there, is when it's in flux, when they're putting this parking structure in, and then they just pour the concrete on top of the bodies, and no one knows the better. I could see it both ways, really. The family and the journalist and Norlander all want to dig or drill back in this area, at the back end of the south end of the garage. It wouldn't cost that much money. Both the journalist and Norlander have offered to pay for it, but the hospital is against it.
Well, the hospital is really only against it because they said, we'll let you do this. You can drill a core sample, which is all they need, really.
Yeah, just a 2-inch hole. So nothing that's going to destroy the parking garage.
But they want the police involved because their fear is if they find any evidence, if there are bodies under there, and if law enforcement is not involved, then this would be inadmissible because you need to have law enforcement involved. Things need to be done by the book.
I get where they're coming from, but if there's 3 anomalies and they core into one and find that it's a body, then they can tell law enforcement, come on in. They can excavate the area and recover the other bodies. So if they core down into one area and there's nothing there, then they can put this rumor to rest. If they core down into one of it and there is a body, and now that's inadmissible, well, they have 2 more. I personally do not believe that the bodies are here. I would almost be willing to pay for it myself just because it's this ongoing saga of, you know, finding Jimmy Hoffa. And I just want them to do it just so people can put it to rest. And Kathy Baird does too. She says, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I just want to know. But the police say, no. If some psychic said that's where it is, we're not going to go drill over there. I mean, it's not a legit source.
Yeah, I personally find the whole thing ridiculous. Think about it this way. If someone comes to you and said, I had a dream, would you stop them right there? I mean, what does a dream mean to you?
I don't know. It got Ryan Ferguson put away for over 9 years.
Yeah, well, that's just backing up my point.
Yeah.
It, you know, these dreams don't matter. And you're talking about an internet poster. So you add in dream and internet poster, and now that's facts. I don't buy it. I think they should have stopped right there. I just went ahead and started reading about how they prepare an area to put concrete slab down on. And in my mind, there's no way that there are bodies there.
They would have seen shallow graves before they would have poured the concrete.
You have to prepare the ground because if the ground settles or moves at all, which is what will happen if bodies decay in there, then the concrete slab will start to break. They can't afford that. This is a hospital. They're going to build it the right way. So they prepare the ground the right way. I understand where the police are coming from. Don't even feed the internet trolls, okay? Don't feed them.
And I agree with your logic. I guess there's a whole TV show called Oak Island where they spend millions of dollars to dig holes to nothing. So what's the harm in drilling a 2-inch hole to get people to understand that there's nothing there?
Well, I think the point you brought up earlier when we talked about this before we started recording made a lot of sense. And that was, you said, we haven't had movement on this case for a long time. They could just do this one little thing. I mean, they haven't really done much else. Nothing else is going on. So do this one small thing. These private citizens are offering to pay for it. The hospital said they'll sign on if the police okay it and they send an officer. So where's the harm? I get that. But on the other hand, with the Oak Island thing, they feel like there's treasure there. So they think, oh, we'll spend $5 million. We're going to get $50 billion. You know, they have it in their heads that there's this huge treasure there that you can't even calculate its worth. So they're still looking for treasure there. This is just a mystery of where these missing women went.
This is a way more honorable pursuit to find a body. And again, I'm not buying into the whole there's bodies there. I think if this guy scanned the entire parking lot, he might find anomalies all over the parking lot. But the mother believes And if she's willing to pay for it, if the journalist is willing to pay for it, if the radar guy is willing to pay for it, then what's the harm of drilling a 2-inch hole?
The only harm I can see is if the psychic or dreamer comes back with another tip.
Well,
because we have another concrete slab that has not been investigated, Justin. On June 7th, which is the day the three women disappeared, there's a business. It's the Preferred Farmers Incorporated business. It's a Westernware company. They were pouring concrete slab for their sign out front. And some have said, maybe the women are under that. So we could actually drill a core and get a core sample at the south parking garage at Cox Hospital and also get a core sample under the PFI sign.
The hospital one seems to have the most traction. So, and if it has the backing for the funders, I probably would have just shown up one night, drilled the hole just to settle my own mind, and then put some epoxy or some concrete down that hole and just not said anything. But I'm not telling anyone to go vandalize a parking structure. But if that's what's going to give the family peace of mind, I think it's a small step for law enforcement to take to appease at least the family. I don't care about the internet trolls, really.
Well, I think part of it, what factors into this is that police had spoken with psychics. You know, of course, they say the same things, which is, oh, they're near a body of water. I'm getting this letter in my head. I'm seeing an R or an S or what have you. And I think it really comes down to what you think about psychics. Now, me personally, we've had psychics write to us and request to come on the show or to help solve cases.
We've even had sponsors, psychics, that we've turned down.
I'm just going to say that I don't believe in psychics. I've never seen anything that tells me that psychics have any kind of statistics on their side. I know that some people believe in it, but there are people that believe in all sorts of things that aren't real. So
we've turned down thousands of dollars to not advertise for a psychic, just so you guys know.
Yeah. And I think that's all that needs to be said on it. Now, I had said that the media was all about this case. There were many articles being written, and there was a lot of information being fed to the media by the police. Well, at the time, the police sort of changed the way that they handled this case as opposed to other cases. And that's because the police chief in Springfield, his name was Knowles, he decided to micromanage the case. And this sort of upset the prosecutor because the police chief is going to the media and saying, here's who we're looking at. These are persons of interest. And this is what we know. And this is why we're interested. And feeding all this information to the media. So the public is following along as armchair detectives do. And everybody's trying to figure out what happened. But the prosecutor's thinking, wait a minute. If we decide to charge anybody, then they might turn around and say, I've already been prejudged. Now the prosecutor's worried that this would amount to police misconduct because the media has been told about everything all along the way. And Chief Knowles is saying, hey, we kept hitting walls. And so we're appealing to the public to help. That makes sense. But now the prosecutor has to worry because if they're ever going to charge anyone, they need to make sure that, you know, like some information you have to keep secret so that if you have the real perpetrator, then they'll have that information and it's not been out there. Now you can't even vet suspects or persons of interest. This is creating a real problem. And as far as I know, it seemed like Chief Knowles decides to not be so helpful to the public anymore with this information, but he never felt like he did anything wrong. A lot of police officers would say privately, off the record, that they felt like they couldn't just follow the leads the way they wanted to because they had to check everything against what Knowles wanted. So if they had some idea and he was like, no, we're going to focus on this now, they had to drop it. You can see how the scene's already been contaminated because they had over 18 people in the house that day coming and going.
Yeah.
And then you have a police chief who's micromanaging everything, telling officers and detectives what they needed to be doing. And then you have a prosecutor worried about police misconduct. And we have yay so many suspects. So this case is a mess.
It truly is. As we always do, we try to break it down. With any case, we have our pros and cons, our check marks, or points that we allocate to different suspects. And really, we've spent all this time focusing on suspects that are more or less stranger danger or people that didn't know the family, except for the brother and the boyfriend. There is some theories or allegations out there on the interwebs that point to people that are closer to the family. We wouldn't do it any justice if we didn't mention everyone that was involved. So whenever you talk about a disappearance or a murder, usually the first person on the scene is considered a suspect, right?
Let's briefly go over the scene. So you have this empty home. The women aren't there. They were supposed to be there. We know that they made it there, but they're missing. There's no sign of a struggle except for that broken light cover, right? No sign of forced entry. It's a complete mystery. So whoever abducted these women had to either get them under control quickly, which is possible. Someone could have gotten in the home and disabled them one by one and then removed them from the home. That's possible. The other possibility is that they knew the perpetrator. They knew who entered the home, or they let that person in the home. And let's just go over this person, Janelle Kirby. She's the one that first started reaching out to them. Now, she did have plans with them to go to a water park that day in Branson. And the only question I have is, why is she contacting them so early? I mean, what's the rush here? Branson's not that far. She's already calling them at 7:30 in the morning. These women, especially the two young girls, didn't go to bed till probably close to 3 or at 3 in the morning. So that's not very much time, especially if you've been drinking. In fact, at some point, Janelle and Mike had gone over to Shane Appleby's house and he was still in bed. And that was at 10:30 or so. So that's not really surprising to me. If I was out drinking all night, I might want to sleep in too. So she's already bugging them and then not finding them. And then when she gets to the house, she says that her boyfriend cleaned up the glass as a favor to Cheryl because Cheryl wouldn't want her porch messed up like that.
And he cleaned up the glass with a broom. And as we stated earlier, I'm sure there wasn't a broom on the porch readily available for him. So they would have had to gone into the house and found the broom. And I think once you step into this house, at least some of the other people that went into the house said, I knew something was wrong immediately. So it's a little questionable. I personally don't think she has much motive or reason here. So I don't put a lot into her being a prime suspect, but she's the first one on the scene and they're cleaning up the crime scene. It doesn't look good.
So she's calling at 7:30. She shows up between 12 and 12:30 and they're cleaning up the glass. It's really strange because she says that the house is immaculate, but it's not. In fact, Cheryl's room seems a little messy and so does Susie's room. And I read that Cheryl's stepdaughter said that Cheryl had a habit of just dropping her shoes off when she was done with them. So she said if she went outside with a pair of sandals or something, and as she was coming up the steps, she could just drop her sandals on the steps or at the entryway into the house, and she would leave them there until she needed them again. So she didn't put her shoes away. The other thing that Janelle was doing was she claimed that she was really good friends with Susie. But when she was referring to Susie in talking to the police, she referred to her as the other girl. And she was mainly talking about Stacy, making it seem like she and Stacy were really good friends, but that she never hung out with both of them at the same time before this. And she also said that because they were good friends, they could just enter each other's homes whenever they wanted to. So it wasn't weird that she just entered the home when she couldn't get a hold of them. but she had never been in that home before. And when police went to speak with the landlord or neighbors at her prior residence at an apartment building, they reported that Cheryl only had a couple of visitors and they were friends of hers. So we don't have any record of Janelle visiting her and just going in her home. It seems like a strange statement to make. And we can't say whether she's just nervous and is trying to cover for herself because she's worried that the police will suspect her when she's not involved, or if she is hiding something. I mean, why say that? Really, they used to be friends a long time ago. And then for a while there, they kind of went off and did their own things and they were more acquaintances. And it's really this graduation where they've reconnected. So I find that suspicious. The other thing is she said, well, I thought maybe they went on without me to Branson, but all their cars are there. And another thing is she was seen in the back of her boyfriend's car crying. This is later in the day. Why would she be in the back of the car? It's just weird because it was supposed to be herself and then Mike, her boyfriend, and then they were supposed to go with Susie and Stacy. So it's just weird that she's in the back of the car. And then this is in the evening here around 10 o'clock or so that people are reporting that she was wearing clothes over her swimsuit that still appeared wet, soaking wet, when she had gone after visiting Susie and Cheryl's house. She had gone on to a more local park known as Hydro Slide. So that was earlier in the day. So we're talking many hours later, she's still soaking wet. It's just kind of an odd detail. So why is she entering the home? And this is something I've thought about. Not everyone does things the same way. And certainly we can't go by this as an isolated incident because we had more than 18 people enter that home.
Yeah.
But all I can say is that we don't know the motive for whoever abducted these women. I just know that Janelle is the one that was the last one to see them. She's the first one that reaches out really early in the morning. She's the first person to get in that house. We don't know what she did. We don't really know why she entered the home. We know that the line that she gives, that they were really good friends and they would just enter each other's homes, doesn't sit well. It doesn't make sense. If we're looking at opportunity, if we're looking at someone that we can place at the scene, then Janelle fits the bill. And I'm not saying she did anything, but I'm saying we could spend hours talking about, well, there was a guy that lived in Missouri who had abducted women in the past and murdered them, or kept them as slaves, or this or that. But I'm saying that's just us going down rabbit holes when we have a woman who's been there and was the last one to see them. So all we really have to go on is her word. And I'm wondering if we're just taking her at her word because she's a friend.
And that's it. I mean, I didn't find anything about her story suspicious because I felt she was the first one to report it or think there was something wrong with the scene. But as we find out, she's not the first one to report it. It's later that day. It's almost a full day later that night before the police are called, before Stacy's mother rings the alarm bells. Again, I think that to abduct three women, take somebody that knows what they're doing, takes weapons, and I would say is a pretty twisted individual. I don't know if she fits that bill myself, but if you isolate this down with a microscope, you have to look at who knew the family. There was no sign of breaking and entering. So it appears that they let this person in, or the person was able to follow them in somehow.
Yeah. And she says that she got a couple of really strange phone calls. And did she? I mean, that's what she says. So it's really up to you to decide whether you believe her or not. But I'm just saying, in this case, we could easily go down any number of rabbit holes on any of these people who could be potential suspects in this case. And she's the first one that stood out to me simply because she's the one that's there throughout the whole story.
And because you mentioned the phone calls, again, they have phone records back then. I mean, I know we don't have caller ID and all this other stuff, but how these two phone calls weren't tracked down, traced back. That just seems unbelievable to me. And I personally believe that if those calls actually happened, that is who the perpetrator was. I think that those calls are the key if they actually happened.
Well, one of the things that's said is the police have investigated much more about this case than we know. They haven't released everything. And I believe they have tracked down the phone calls. They say they have a group of people in mind. Now, what that means, I don't know. But again, when you have all these kids who know each other and you have Janelle's boyfriend who knows Dustin Rekla, Michael Clay, and some of these other guys, we don't know how they're all connected. We don't know if any of that matters. I know that I spent a lot of time looking into Michael Clay and Dustin Rekla because you think on the face of it, these guys had invaded a mausoleum. They had desecrated corpses. They had removed gold from teeth and they were in the spotlight. Detectives went to Clay's home and his sister was there and Michael was not. But when they were looking into the house, they saw what they said were occult-like items. And then when they went back to the house later, when Michael Clay would be there, those items were all removed. So for them, that was sort of an alarm bell there. Like, uh-oh, wait a minute. Could they have been involved in some occult activity? After all, they had broken into a mausoleum. But I can tell you that even though Dustin has been very, very quiet, Michael Clay is all over the internet. He had been posting on forums for a number of years and actually talking about the case. And something he said sort of, I guess, made a lot of sense to me. He said that Dustin really loved Susie and he would never harm her. Now, I know you could say, well, of course he's going to say that. But the other thing he said that made even more sense to me was the charges that we had, not worth killing anybody over. They're just not serious enough. And I thought back, well, wait a minute, you guys all jetted. There were three of you that left town. There was Rekla, Clay, and Rydell. And they all left town. And they were the grave robbers. Well, why did they skip town? Well, they knew they were going to face charges and they didn't want to be there for them. But again, they're kids. They're 17 years old or whatever. They're just skipping town. They want to get out of town. So in the end, I can't really believe that they're behind this, not personally. If other people out there think that they're very good suspects, I get it. I think that any one of the people that we named could be a good suspect. The problem is you have to find a way to place them there at the house, give them the opportunity, and find some kind of motive, which I think to this day, we don't know what the motive was. I don't know about you, Justin, but in all my reading, it seems like most people believe this was sexually motivated, either human trafficking or someone latched on to one of the victims and wanted them. Personally, I think going after three people is a risky, risky move. And so for me, yeah, it can be done. But what if they had shouted loud enough and someone heard and you had people turning on lights and coming outside? And to me, it's too risky. For me, this was desperation. I think that whatever happened to these women happened because someone felt they had to stop them. Maybe they had information they were going to leak out. I don't know. But for whatever reason, this happened because someone was desperate. That's my opinion.
I don't think the teens did it because the purses were left with money in them. And I think, well, if I'm a teen and I'm getting into trouble, I'm going to take money. I might be a little jaded or tainted by all the serial killers we cover because I feel that this is something like that, a Dennis Rader or a Richard Ramirez type situation, somebody that's a really bad person. And the lack of struggle, the lack of blood in the house, I feel it's somebody that has a gun and is able to get them to comply. Just real straight and simple. And I don't think teenagers are capable of doing this in such a professional or systematic manner.
I do think it's possible that one or more persons was able to get into the home. Again, I don't know that the doors were locked. I don't know that. One of the things that investigators did notice, And I don't believe, I know this is a stretch maybe, but I don't believe that anybody who visited the house did this. But inside Cheryl Levitt's room, the blinds were parted as if someone put their hand into the blind and separated the blinds to look out the window. At that point, is that because Cheryl heard something? Someone alerted her and she got up to go look? I don't know. I can't say. But if someone did get in the home while everyone was asleep, or at least most everyone was asleep, then they could get the upper hand. Because if you're being woken up and there's a gun in your face, what are you going to do? You're probably not going to scream.
No. You got the drop on you. You're at a disadvantage.
But really, I think as you go over the evidence in this case, and there's a lot of it, and we didn't cover everything that happened the night of the parties. A lot of people make a big deal about some of the other boys that they had partied with. And there's this idea that maybe there were some people at one of the parties who noticed the girls or one of them and started following them from there. And that's also possible.
Yeah, it's just a random opportunity thing. I mean, I truly think that somebody followed them home and then waited and then unscrewed that light cover to take out that light bulb, probably dropped it when they were either trying to screw it back in or when they were taking it off, something to that effect. I don't think it was broken during a struggle and somebody kicked up in the air. But yeah, it could be anybody, and there's so many different suspects here.
Since the case is unsolved, and it's been unsolved for 25 years, I don't know that it'll ever be solved. I noticed when Justin and I were just talking about it off the show, at times we got a little heated with each other just because each of us has our own points of view on it. And you just heard it. I mean, Justin feels like maybe there could have been a serial killer involved. I almost think that this was someone who knew them and felt they needed to remove them. But whatever your theory is at this point, I think there's validity to it because we don't have enough information. All we know is that these three women disappeared. We know they didn't run away. We know that Cheryl had a decent amount of money in her purse at the time. And these young women had bright futures. There was no sign of any struggle. They just literally disappeared. I think that's why so many people latch onto this case when they discover it, because there are so many rabbit holes to go down. You could pick one person who's named in this case as just a person that knew the victims. And I'm calling them victims because we've never found them. Foul play was involved. I think everybody agrees on that. They're not hiding out in Mexico. That's not happened. But you can literally go down any one of these rabbit holes. And I remember Justin saying earlier, Robert Cox saying, after my mother dies, I'll tell everything. Well, she's in her 80s. And I don't know how much time she has left, but I think there are people who find Cox to be quite a good suspect. My only question is why would he go after three women? I do agree that throughout all of my research, everyone's trying to figure out which person was the target. And I almost feel like if there was a target, it was probably the girls, because they were the ones who were going place to place to place. And so I thought, well, what if Cheryl was the target and someone went in there and got her, and then the girls got home and kind of interrupted, or the perpetrator kind of hid Cheryl for a little bit and then went after the girls after they went to bed. But it doesn't seem likely to me. It just doesn't feel right. I almost feel like someone was tracking these girls, and after they got home, waited a bit and then made their entry, either by just knocking on the door, like we talked about, if someone was wearing a line locator uniform and said, hey, I've got to talk to you about, we have a gas leak. You know, gases, you can't smell all of them. And if someone came to your house and said, we've got a gas problem and your life is in danger, you need to exit the premises. He might say, you need to go this way, like you need to go out the back or you need to go out the side. He can direct them where to go because he's wearing a uniform. It's possible. So again, go down any one of these rabbit holes and see where you end up. I wouldn't be surprised if many of you are thinking that we're both wrong.
And that's fine. I like Aaron said, any person involved in this case, you could drill into them and find them to appear suspicious. And we always go through family members and friends and take them at their word and then go for the real bad people. But in this case, nothing adds up. Everyone's changed their story, and alibis are few and far between.
When you go down the list of people that the police have spoken with, a lot of them were given lie detector tests, you know, polygraphs. And one out of quite a number of them was a fail. The rest of them all passed. Now, of course, we have the police who will say everyone remains a person of interest because this hasn't been solved. I've heard it a number of times where a police officer will say, well, this could all change with one phone call, one tip. And if it ends up being so-and-so who we'd already looked at, it wouldn't surprise us. Now, 5 years after the disappearance, Cheryl Levitt and Susie Streeter are legally declared dead. But Stacy McCall has never been legally declared dead because even though her mother Janice says that she probably is deceased, she won't stop looking until they find answers. I know I would like to hear what you have to say about this case. So if you want to write to us at genypod@gmail.com and make the subject Springfield 3. And just let us know who you like as the suspect or what your theory is in this missing person's case. If you think it's Mike Kovacs, one of Susie's ex-boyfriends, if you think it was the work of a serial killer, we have a number of them that make for suspects in this case, or if you think there was foul play by someone who was close to them, let us know. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.